Good evening and welcome to the brand new Veterans Radio Show, The Warrior Connection. My name is Doug Rocky, and we're glad that you're all coming around with us. It's going to be a very interesting show as we begin this series. The purpose and intent of Warrior Connection is to discuss the physiological and psychological effects of war, the history of war, and the environmental consequences of war, as we've known it, as we've experienced it, and as we want to see what happens to make sure we're all taken care of. As we begin our discussion, we're going to have various guests on the show over the next few weeks and months, hopefully, and we'll keep going on there, to discuss what we have seen, what we have known, and what needs to be done. And as we look into the future, hopefully it'll all come together. My name again is Doug Rocky. I'm a retired Army officer. I served in the Vietnam War as a bomb-nap hard hat, flying B-52s and maintaining the avionics systems. I went on and became a combat medic in the Army National Guard. Spent time in the Army Reserve as an Army instructor, as a combat medic, and a nuclear biological chemical warfare instructor. Then all of a sudden, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, some 19 years after I first came in, I got a direct commission as a second lieutenant and ended up retiring. It's been a long and an interesting period. Tonight, with our inaugural show, I want to dedicate this show to those of my team that died and others that have died in service in Iraq, Kuwait, and everything else. Some of those, again, include Sergeant Major Jim Runge, again, one of my great friends. He was in charge of preventive medicine during Desert Storm. Dr. Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath, the doctor on our team, another fine hero of America and everything else, dedicated to the military, and he spent many, many years. He retired as a full colonel and went on and died a few months ago. We also had Colonel Bill Arell. Bill Arell was responsible for moving all of the contaminated equipment during Operation Desert Storm. He brought it on back to us at KKMC at King 5. He moved it all around, and then he went on up when Doha blew up and did all that cleanup and moving all the junk around. Then we had Mad Dog and Blue and Kiefer and Sergeant First Class John Sitton, who was a very good friend of mine, both in the civilian world and in the military world. John Sitton set up the medical evacuation during Operation Desert Storm, and he died of cancer, as did Bill Arell and all the others, and Jim Runge, just abandoned for what they had. These are quite interesting individuals. In the current war, we lost friends here from my own community, Major David Otto, and another one that I had known from childhood, Sergeant Chris Rosinski. So to these people, to this show is what it's dedicated, and all the others that came after them. Well, as we continue on, let's talk about what has happened with military operations and everything else. Vietnam, which is my first experience, again, we all bought into that. We went over to Vietnam, and as we know, Agent Orange has ripped apart the Vietnam veteran community, and it continues to create a lot of problems. The health and environmental effects of Agent Orange were always known. Admiral Elmo Zumwalt wrote an actual report back in 1990 confirming all of the serious health and environmental effects of Agent Orange. This report originally was classified by the Department of Veterans Affairs, but it then became declassified some years ago. And what's interesting, Admiral Zumwalt wrote this report in May 5th of 1990 is when he put it on out. But during the thing, what his findings were is that all the medical effects we've seen today definitely came from Agent Orange. And he also did, and I want to read this as a direct quote, and said, quote, "I further conclude that the Veterans Advisory Committee on Environmental Hazards has not acted with impartiality in its review and assessment of scientific evidence related to the association of adverse health effects and exposure to Agent Orange." Incredible. To this day, those of us who were served in Vietnam are still struggling with it. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't run into a veteran that's either had health and environmental effects from Vietnam all the way through the current time, Desert Storm, up to Iraqi freedom, Enduring Freedom, and Operation New Dawn. Serious, serious things that we have to look at. Well, during the Vietnam era, we not only had the problems with Agent Orange, we had all kinds of endemic diseases, and those ran rampant. We also had malaria that we had to deal with. And we know today, all of us that ate the anti-malaria pills, that we know those have very serious adverse health effects. And that's something you did talk to your actual physician about, whether it be a Department of Veteran Affairs physician or your private physician. But they need to be aware of that so you can discuss all of the different things that we have, that stuff. Well, we continued on. Throughout the 1980s, the United States Army, in its support of Iraq, deliberately and willfully provided Iraq with the chemical and biological weapons that they needed to use an attack against Iran. So again, we come on down, and right now we're about a snail's pace away from going into war with Iran. But one thing that we don't talk about, and this is what led into the disaster, what we know as Desert Storm, is that the United States deliberately and willfully sent biological and chemical warfare munitions to Iraq for use against the Iranians throughout the 1980s and against the Iraqi Kurds. And the list of things goes on and on. Probably the main item that we need to be concerned with, again, was provided directly by the U.S. Army from Fort Detrick, Maryland, to Iraq was anthrax. Everybody knows what anthrax is, how serious it is, and everything else. And what had happened, that the U.S. Army out of Fort Detrick, Maryland, had deliberately and willfully made several shipments of Bacillus anthracis directly to Iraq, knowing that they were going to use it on the Iranians. Well, obviously, when Desert Storm came about, we knew what the list, this huge list of chemical and biological warfare agents was. And as a consequence, as we started to get everything up together at the theater command headquarters where I was at for the medical command, 3rd MedCom, we knew that Iraq had anthrax. That necessitated that what we did go about doing, because we didn't have the adequate amount of antibiotics, Cipro and doxycycline, which are the prominent antibiotics to fight off any anthrax infection, we didn't have any of that available, and there was no way to get it out to anybody. So made the conscious choice to administer the anthrax vaccine. The same thing with the botulinum toxin vaccine. Again, the botulinum toxin was another biologic warfare agent the U.S. Army provided directly to Iraq throughout the 1980s. So all this stuff is stockpiled. So now we're looking at a very serious problem. We know that Iraq has weaponized anthrax because we gave it to them. We absolutely gave it to them. So we had to administer the vaccine. Unfortunately, the vaccine, which again was coming out of Michigan at Bioports, there wasn't enough of it. We had about three-quarters of a million of us in Desert Storm over in the area, an area where anthrax could be dispersed, and we didn't have enough vaccine. Well, first decision was to administer the vaccine and decide who got how many doses, when, and how much based on rank and position within the Army. Unfortunately, some of the young kids who were on the front lines where we knew it would be used didn't get all of the protection that was necessary. Well, we ran into a problem because the anthrax vaccine, again, was for cutaneous anthrax, and not respiratory anthrax. We also didn't have enough of it. So in order to get it built up, what they did go about doing, and again, this is all in a solid documentation report, the National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine, Department of Defense, they decided to use a different type of vaccine. And they took this vaccine and they used a not very reliable and not very well-known adjuvant called squalene. And the purpose of this is squalene, you could take one dose and turn it into 50 doses. Again, that's how well the adjuvant worked. So again, there we run into a problem. The other thing we ran into with the anthrax vaccine is we knew there was directly physiological effects for those individuals that took it. So the order was issued not to tell anybody how much they had, who got the doses, when they got it, or report any of the adverse health effects from the anthrax vaccine. And again, this is also for the botulinum toxin vaccine. Again, both of these were necessitated because the United States gave both of these biological agents to Iraq for use on the Iranians, which they did do, and on any of the Iraqi Kurds, and then lo and behold, here it comes on us. So we had a whole host of things happening. When we look at all of the different exposures that happened during Operation Desert Storm, it became frightening for most of us very rapidly. Because, again, we knew what we did have. We knew where it was. So the first thing we had, again, with the biologicals was a chemical agent. Again, the Iraq possessed chemical agents because we gave it to them. And some of these were nerve agents, including sarin, cyclosarin, Tabun, Soman, VX, multiple 7, and Novichoks. Each one of these are anticholinergic. In other words, they're nerve agents, create a nightmare for individuals. Well, in order to protect us, they decided to administer the pyridoxygmine bromide, which are PB tabs. So it's the little white tablets in the foil packets that everybody got to eat. Again, they came in a 21-day supply, and you were supposed to take it. Again, once more, they didn't tell everybody that PB is actually a carbamate-based pesticide itself. And what it does is it puts you into a pesticide poisoning to begin with as you eat them. The purpose of this, again, with the PB is the fact that we knew Iraq had the nerve agents that were provided to them by the United States and their allies, and also obviously out of the Soviet Union with some of their agents. And so we knew we had to have that on hand. Well, in order to protect everybody, they gave the PB with the intent, if they got hit by the nerve agents, they could take the antidote. Again, this is the old Mark I kit that everybody carried around. You had three of those available, or you were supposed to have three of those available with you at all times. And atropine, diazepam, chloride, and pyridoxine. So these are the different drugs, again, that you took for this. So we had a problem. In addition to that, again, with the nerve agents, we had a total misuse of pesticides. So here we're running into a nightmare. We have nerve agents being released through the destruction and detonation of Iraq's bunkers, which we made the decision to do in December 1990. We have Iraq using them, releasing them all over the place. And then we have all this stuff just coming back and haunting us. So incredible problems on top of that with the misuse of pesticides. So the individuals are getting super zapped by very low levels of nerve agents, from chemical warfare agents through the PB, which is a drug, on into the pesticides, which were necessary, again, to control all the pests and the bugs that we had throughout the area of operations. So, again, people are getting nailed all the way across. This is not a good day in River City. Definitely not a good day in River City. Immunizations, we've talked about those. Radiological materials. Well, radiological materials are broken down into certain areas. A lot of equipment contains radiological materials. One thing that we learned during Operation Desert Storm, and especially with the 3rd U.S. Army Captured Equipment Project, for which I did have responsibility also, is that most of the Iraqi equipment that we were blowing up and destroying had all kinds of radioactive isotopes contained within it. So as we destroyed all of their equipment, we released these radioactive isotopes into the environment. As you climbed all over the stuff at the Highway of Death or any other places, you were again with exposed to radioactive materials. If you got any of their artillery or their anti-aircraft guns, again, radioactive material exposure. So now we have radioactive materials via inhalation, ingestion, absorption, and direct exposure. A whole host of things. Again, alpha particles, beta and gammas, x-rays, and a whole host of things of exposures. The radiological materials. The other thing that we primarily had, and I had direct responsibility for, was depleted uranium. Depleted uranium was a primary isotope, again, from the enrichment process of the U.S. Department of Energy. With depleted uranium, what we had to see happen is that the Department of Energy needed to get rid of incredible amounts of uranium hexafluoride. Well, the easiest way to do this was to turn this into munitions, and they did. So during Operation Desert Storm, the depleted uranium munitions that we had available to us consisted of the 20-millimeter on the Navy Phalanx, and that's about 250 grams of solid uranium. But it's got more than just uranium in it. It also has plutonium, neptunium, and americium. In addition to that, we had the 30-millimeter, which is about 300 grams fired by the A-10 Warthog aircraft. Incredibly effective against armor, structures, hospitals, water treatment facilities, anything. The A-10 shot it all up and the bunkers. In addition to that, we had the 105-millimeter tank round, the 120-millimeter tank round, and 125-millimeter tank round. Each individual tank round, about 120-millimeter, each one of those is about 10 pounds, or a little over 4,500 grams of solid uranium. Again, uranium-238, uranium-234, uranium-235, uranium-236, plutonium, neptunium, and americium. Again, that's what the DU munitions consist of. Up and beyond that, we had the perfect dirty bomb. And these are the cluster bombs. And these are the atom and the petum. And to understand what they are, think about a softball. You got a softball in your hands. And the outer casing of that softball is the DU, is the radioactive materials, and it's filled with high explosives. Again, these are used very effectively. These are anti-personnel bombs. These are cluster bombs. They are America's perfect dirty bomb. So, again, we have all of this stuff. With the use of depleted uranium munitions, there had been inadequate training put forth. Now, we did get a message in December of 1990 to start doing some training at 3rd MedCom headquarters, and our team, Bauer's Raiders, under Dr. Colonel Ulrich Bauer, who reported to D.G. Zulus, the 3rd MedCom commander, did start training. We trained on the medical and management, chemical and biological casualties, and started training somewhat on DU. Unfortunately, protective procedures were not in place. And so what happened is we went up and shot the place all up with uranium munitions, radioactive, America's perfect dirty bomb. Well, with the completion of the ground war, they had realized, oh my, we haven't put anything in place, have not put in place the medical care necessary. We haven't even given the troops the personal protective equipment they need. And we don't know how to clean up the mess after it's done. Well, lo and behold, one of those messages came on down from the Pentagon to General Norman Schwarzkopf and told General Schwarzkopf to go find me, go find Doug Rocky and his team, and tell them to clean it up. Well, lo and behold, here we go again. We've been teaching the medical management, chemical, biological casualties, setting up all the decontamination stations, dealing with all the hazardous materials, incidents throughout the theater, dealing with the water and food contamination from, again, the biological agents that are there and the endemic diseases, and now we got to go DU. Well, you know, it's just one of those things that you have to do. And being an old enlisted, being an old sergeant, you know, once upon a time they called me Sergeant Rock. When we were teaching courses, hey, here comes Sergeant Rock. Man, you know, they look for some giant man, and here I come bopping along, you know, all 150, 160 pounds of me. But it was interesting. So anyhow, we went up to clean it up. What we found out rapidly, there are no precautions to take care of. We had to isolate all the contaminated equipment, and that consisted of 16 Abrams tanks and 15 Bradley fighting vehicles. One of the Abrams tanks had been destroyed early in December. It had already been shipped out. The other 15 Abrams tanks we collected, along with the 15 Bradleys, we collected those at KKMC. And that, again, was with the 144th Maintenance Battalion. And those guys did not get any warning. As soon as we got up there, we isolated everything. We started trying to get medical care set up. We got rid of all the contaminated clothing and equipment, and then we had to start figuring out what to do. Well, it took a handful of us a little while to do it, but eventually what we decided to do is that all of the Abrams would be shipped back to the United States as soon as we could remove the unstable, unexploded ordnance, remove a lot of the radiological contamination on the outside. In other words, button them up and seal them up so we could ship them back to the United States. So we shipped all of the 15 Abrams tanks on back to the United States on board a Ro-Ro that I'd taken from the 82nd Airborne. General wasn't a happy camper over at AMC Port B in Dammam. But we shipped those all back, and they landed at Charleston, South Carolina. They were then taken to Barnwell, South Carolina, to the Defense Consolidation Facility, and 4 years later they finally got them cleaned up where they could bury them or dispose of them. Well, on the Bradley fighting vehicles, we had a total of 15 Bradley fighting vehicles. Again, what we had to do was bury some in place, and we had to ship some back to the United States that could be, you know, recovered and put back into use, so we did those. We had to bury a lot of stuff in the desert. That was one of the disturbing parts. We couldn't clean it up. We couldn't remove the body parts that were left over. We couldn't remove the contamination. We had radiological contamination, unexploded ordnance, and all of this stuff, so nasty stuff. And we had to get rid of it. So that's what happened. Along this way, I initially set up all the medical care, made the recommendations for medical care. And my recommendations were then formalized in June of 1991 from the 3rd U.S. Army Medical Command, where they ordered medical care for all of the individuals exposed to not only depleted uranium, but all the other radiological materials. We'd already set up medical care for all the chemical and biological exposure casualties, but again, to this day, it's still not happening. Unfortunately, to this day, it's still not happening. As a result of the use of depleted uranium munitions by the U.S. military, most of those who were killed in action during Desert Storm and those who were wounded in action during Desert Storm were the result of depleted uranium-friendly fire on the U.S. and also the British side. We were not allowed to help the British or inform them of what was happening. They were just kind of left on their own and left to blow in the wind. And that's exactly what DU does. It blows in the wind. A horrible, horrible, horrible mess. Well, we set up the medical care, and the medical care is required as a radiobioassay. In other words, we needed to collect the urine, we needed to collect feces, and do a nasal and pharyngeal swab not later than 72 hours after exposure. So if you're exposed one day, you got a day and a half before you're supposed to collect the samples and submit those for analysis. What we do know, and as we learned as I developed all the other protocols for this, is that DU medical testing must happen no more than 30 days post-exposure. After 30 days, the biological half-life elimination of the mobile fraction that could be found in the urine or the feces, et cetera, drops down to less than 1/1000th of what hit the body. Unfortunately, to this day, the radiobioassay has never been done for most of the friendly fire casualties from Desert Storm. Have friendly fire casualties have DU shrapnel in them, have still not got their medical care. And then same thing happened when we went into the Balkans in 94 and 95. Again, medical care has never been done. Same thing with Somalia in 1993. And again, the medical care has never been done. We get to the Balkans in 99. And then obviously we go into Afghanistan, Iraq, current time. Again, not done properly. No intention of doing it. We were given a direct order in March of 1991. This is called the Los Alamos Memorandum. And what it was a direct order to lie in all about the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions and all after-action reports to sustain the use of DU munitions. An absolute nightmare. And that operational order is still in place. So it came on down. We came on back. We tried to get it all cleaned up. We tried to get all the health and environmental effects known of everything that was happening. Tried to get medical care set up. And to this day, we're still having a problem. Just not a good day in River City. Endemic diseases were a nightmare throughout Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Kuwait. Okay, they also endemic diseases were brought in by all of the military personnel and civilian personnel and support personnel that came in from all the nations involved in the whole coalition. So again, we ended up with a nightmare. Hazardous materials. Again, hazardous materials turned into a total nightmare. We had the 7th Corps hazardous waste dump up in Iraq, and I remember getting called into the boss's office, and he said, "Hey, Doug, you and my G4 go clean up the hazardous materials waste in Iraq for the 7th Corps." And, well, we went and did it. Today, the criteria that sit together for identifying the toxic exposure of all these hazardous materials compounds by actual chemical compound name is contained in a book that was written in 1999. And again, this is exposures for hazardous materials for military personnel. And it's a USA CHIPM 230A is the book. So it's a technical guide 230A that was written and published in May of 1999. So all this stuff is coming together. The hazardous materials exposures, devastating throughout the theater of operations because of the use, the maintenance, the operations, the releases, as we blew up Iraq's and Kuwait's infrastructure. So again, we have that. The other thing we have with hazardous materials, we have an incredible hazardous materials exposures back here in the United States or any other location where the military operates. And we're seeing incredible levels of hazardous materials contamination exposures at all the closed military installations. A lot of things to think about, ladies and gentlemen. A lot to think about. Oil well fires. Well, Kuwait had a lot of oil wells, as did Iraq. And what had happened is they were all set on fire. And we knew that the oil well fire medical problems would be there. The Kennison memo from the 3rd U.S. Army Medical Command stated very clearly as they were set on, nobody should be anywhere near them without full respiratory and skin protection. Medical care for, again, lymphoid pneumonia and all these other things and all the medical problems from the known problems in the cold-hitting industry, which is where we have suspended oil and is ingested, inhaled, and everything else, was an absolute necessity, but it wasn't done. When we did the analysis on the different chemical compounds that were in the oil, what we had is ozone, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, acetophene, benzoanthracene, biphenyl, chrysine, fluoroanthrene, phenylanthrene, pyrene, particulates, cadmium, chromium, nickel, lead, vanadium, zinc. And we go to benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, MP-xylene, and O-xylene. This is some of the chemical compounds that were in the oil well fires. Any one of these are a physiological nightmare. But when we combine everything together, we end up having what's called synergistic relation actions. Just a horrible, horrible nightmare. Again, medical care was ordered and directed, but it didn't happen. It did not happen. Where does this all leave us? Where does this all leave us? Something to consider. The Department of Defense sent all of us to war, whether it was during the Vietnam era or it moved on into all the other combat operations that have taken place since then up to the current time. Many of our weapon systems have horrible health effects, both physiological and psychological. We contaminate air, water, soil, food, and water. And then we leave everybody out to dry. The question is, who is responsible and what needs to be done in the future? A nightmare of untold proportions. A total nightmare of untold proportions. So let's think about what has happened with everything else. The number of casualties that we have seen as a consequence of Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, moving into the current time. The Department of Veteran Affairs published their report, Department of Veteran Affairs Gulf War Veterans Information System. Now, they started publishing many, many years ago, but the last issue that was published in February of 2008. And what had happened, the VA was putting them, but they couldn't deal with the reports coming down, the incredible numbers of casualties, all the incredible numbers of people that are submitting claims, permanent medical care and disabilities with the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. So the Department of Veteran Affairs, in their formal report, when we're looking at February 2008, in February 2008, they acknowledged that the number of service members that served in Operation Desert Storm, Desert Shield, was 696,842. As of February 2008, only 618,000 were left alive. So we had over 75,000 that had died along the way. Very young kids. Very healthy before they went to war. As of February 2008, the Department of Veterans Affairs had received disability claims for 278,713 individuals. This is in February of 2008. You know, and again, we're looking at the whole thing, and out of that 278,000, they had awarded 221,000, about 222,000 medical care and CMP for the health and environmental effects, the exposures, toxic exposures, and wounds from Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. We have to remember, though, we only had probably maybe 300 wounded in action. 300 wounded in action is all. And then we're looking in 2008, the VA's acknowledged already 222,000. Well, the latest claims and everything, again, as we're looking at Desert Storm with the VA, we now know there's over 300,000. Over 300,000. Desert Shield and Desert Storm veterans have serious medical problems, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. The question is, who's responsible? And what responsibility will the Department of Defense and the Department of Veteran Affairs accept for the incredible medical problems that everybody has experienced? I'm thinking we might need to go back and discuss what casualties are right now. During wartime, casualties are classified as wounded in action. Those are the individuals who get shot or blown up through direct enemy engagement. In other words, the enemy wounds you and you live. The other ones we have are killed in action, KIA. And again, this happens during direct enemy engagement, a firefight, a battle, bombs, or whatever. And these are the individuals that are wounded or shot up or blown up and did die. Unfortunately, the majority of casualties going back to antiquity are what we call DNBI, disease and non-battle injury, DNBI. The DNBI casualties, again, are overwhelming the number. So when we look at those, we got over 222,000 as of February 2008 that are acknowledged and already been awarded disability as disease and non-battle injury casualties out of Desert Storm. But again, they're not taking care of the other 60,000 individuals that have applied. A horrible, horrible nightmare. Where do we go from here? What do we do next? Well, as all the battles and operations continued on, the next thing we did run into is everything in the Balkans. And this is in 1994, 1995, again in 1996. Again, depleted uranium munitions were used extensively throughout the Balkans. They extensively used the bunker busters, and they also used the ATIM and the PDIM. And the United Nations Pekka Vista, who was in charge of that program, had told the Department of Defense to clean up the residue, but it never happened to this day. So we're seeing incredible medical problems and deceased service members from all the nations who went into the Balkans. Again, a problem beyond comprehension. Well, as we come on up, we start coming into the current situation. And what do we do? How do we take care of everything? How do we put it together and put it into some kind of criteria that's going to help everybody? Well, one of the things we had to have to come down and learn about is that the medical problems are a catastrophe. Some of the latest reports from the Department of Veteran Affairs, when we look at the total number of casualties, DNBI casualties for Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation New Dawn. Last October, again, we're looking at a few months old now, we had 711,986 disease and non-battle injury casualties that have already gone to the Department of Veteran Affairs for medical care, and they're getting medical care. The latest data, again, which is less amount, little about over a few weeks old or a month old, puts the number at 750,000. So we're looking at 750,000 veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and Operation New Dawn that are always having serious medical problems. Again, we can look at it pretty much across the board and know what we have. The proportions are the same. The Department of Veteran Affairs ICD-9 diagnostic codes that's already been confirmed for the 750,000, which matches the 300,000 from Desert Storm, are infectious and parasitic diseases, malignant neoplasms, these are confirmed cancers, benign neoplasms. These are the where you have all kinds of tumors, but they're not malignant. Diseases of the endocrine nutritional metabolic system. Diseases of the blood and blood-forming organs. This is leukemia. I was on an airplane flying into Pennsylvania to go give a talk near the Army War College, and a young soldier was on there. He was flying back because his family had come down from leukemia, and he definitely was exposed to DU. There was no doubt about it. He confirmed that he had definitely had all the problems. We get into PTSD, which we'll need to come back with and discuss quite a bit during this radio show. Nervous system, sense organs, incredible neurological problems from all of the combined exposures. Cardiac and circulatory system problems, respiratory problems, digestive. I think everybody lives with explosive diarrhea and constipation. We never know which way it's going to go. General unitary problems and the rash, the diseases of skin, all the dermatology. Incredible problems with the rash. All of us that live with the rash and all of us that live with the neurological and the respiratory problems, we have to understand it's normal for this problem. But again, this is not from bullets and bombs, ladies and gentlemen. This is from toxic exposures. We have incredible numbers of musculoskeletal system connective tissue problems. Again, myself, one thing we need to consider on this, when we have a traumatic brain injury, remember we have enough explosive force concussions or knockdown or whatever to rattle the brain. But the brain inside the skull, which is basically on a toothpick to the rest of the body. And so what they're not talking about, and what has happened to many of myself and my team members, is we now know we have serious cervical spine injuries requiring surgery. That up and beyond the TBI and up and beyond all the musculoskeletal problems. And then you have all the ill-defined symptoms and they have the injuries and poisonings. Well, that's some of the diseases that we're running into with this whole host of problems. I think right now, if we've got anybody that's listening in, if they'd like to call in and join in with our conversation, please call 888-874-4888. Again, to join in with us and make some contributions on this first show, 888-874-4888. Now, as we go through, I'm definitely going to be bringing guests on, some of the other experts that I've worked with, bringing experts from dealing with TRICARE. We'll deal with how do we deal with PTSD, how do we deal with all the different areas that we're looking at, how do we deal with the history of the military and what's happened there. So those are some of the things we're going to go over all over the next period of time, and this should be very, very interesting. So as we look at all this, one thing that we have to understand is the Department of Veteran Affairs right now in their latest reports is estimating that we're probably going to have anywhere in the ball game of 1.3 to 1.2 million casualties out of Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. The VA is starting to have some budget planning for about 1.5 million casualties. Where's the money? Where's the knowledge? What needs to be done? Something that has to be considered over and over and over again. As we continue on, how about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? We might want to talk about that. How do we deal with it? Who do we go for help with it? But what does it consist of? In my military service, which started in 1967 through Vietnam, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, helped put together Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and too many other events in between to count, PTSD is a function of three things. The normal combat stress, the normal stuff that goes back to antiquity, where each and every one of us goes complete tranquility to sheer terror in a nanosecond. We bounce back and forth from tranquility to terror so many times in a day, in a month, in a week, in a year, in a military career that you have no idea what's happening, and especially in war. Very few, if anybody, is able to withstand the psychological impact of going from tranquility to terror back and forth continually. Up and beyond that, what we have just demonstrated as we've discussed it tonight is the incredible levels of neurotoxicity. In other words, all the toxic materials, whether it be radiological, biological, or chemical, and the complex mixtures of all this stuff, which is synergistic enough together. In other words, I just don't have the physiological effects. Say, for example, if I have the pesticide and a nerve agent combining together, those don't add up 2 plus 2 is 4. They come to be 2 plus 2 is 9. In other words, the combined effects is far greater and far worse than a single effect. And that's what's happened throughout all these military operations and since I go back to my time beginning in Vietnam. So incredible levels of neurotoxicity. What happens is the toxic exposures affect the neural functioning of the brain. The brain doesn't work well. It's been poisoned. One of the guys on my team and a great American chemical NCO in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps, who also just be one heck of a combat medic, so he was not only a 54 Bravo, but he was a 91 Super B. He called it, who am I? Why am I here? How did I get here, and where am I supposed to go? The fog of neurotoxic poisoning, of brain poisoning. One of my best friends, again, one of the great American heroes from Vietnam through Desert Storm, is Sergeant First Class Ronald Dolph. Again, my best friend, my partner in all this stuff, we've been doing this together. I mean, we were teaching civilian emergency medical care and emergency rescue of civilians, and we started doing it for the National Guard. We went to the Army Reserve when they called us to do it, and then when the active Army said, hey, we need these guys to come, off we went again. Well, one time we were just not even a block from his grandparents, and he got lost. One block from his grandparents, and he got lost. I hear that all the time. The neurotoxic exposures. So as we come through those, the other thing that we're looking at happening with the neurotoxic exposure is memory. Can your memory function? How well is your memory? We've had doctors and nurses that serve in all of these conflicts that were exposed have had to quit practicing medicine. They couldn't count on their memory anymore. Could not count on their memory anymore. And then we have all of us that just try to remember the simplest thing like, who is that? Oh, that's my best friend's parents. Who is that? Oh, that's my aunt or my uncle. That's my cousin. But because of the toxic exposures on the memory, you can't remember their names. You can't remember their names. Mental processing is another nightmare that comes about from this stuff. Again, there's a lot of specific tests the Department of Veteran Affairs and the Department of Defense can do on those. Again, this is neuropsychology. You need to get a top-notch expert, a doctor who's both a psychiatrist, looks at the brain function, and a medical doctor, an MD. So they have to have the expertise in both areas and ask for this. And they look at neural function. How do you do problem solving? Well, we're all running into that problem solving problem. We're all running into the memory problems. But the other thing, too, that needs to be considered, and somehow it all gets missed, is not where are you in relationship to the normal standard population, but where were you before you had the neurotoxic exposures at your functioning level? And where are you afterwards? I saw some of the most brilliant individuals that I've ever worked with in both civilian and military worlds, the universities. After they were exposed, they had dropped down what were called 2 or 3 standard deviations. They still might be better than your average Joe Schmo in the, out there in, that works in a factory. But for them, it's a devastating effect. This average individual now has had the devastating effect. What does he do? How does he do it? He has an incredible amount of physiological problems. Now we have neuropsychological problems. How do we get employed? How do we hold a job? If you have all the neuromuscular problems, you're not going to be able to do heavy labor. if you have all of the memory problems, you have to find a thing where you can ease back and do the stuff within your limits and within your qualifications. So we have a nightmare there of itself. A lot of things to consider, a lot of things to think about. So PTSD, only one we say we're peeing in our pants scared. Neurotoxic exposures. And then the last part that we have to consider as we think about all this is, what is the truth about our military operations? Was it necessary to go to war? Didn't we go to war against an enemy that had the capability to suspend our basic rights, suspend our Bill of Rights that are enumerated in the U.S. Constitution or other stuff enacted by our legislatures? Or did we go to war over something else? We're looking at today incredible, incredible ethical and moral dilemmas. As we went to war, the question came up, is it justified? Then the average warrior, as he killed and destroyed, comes up in his mind and said, is it justified? Not from the hoo-ha and the John Wayne and the Rambo of war, but the reality of war. Did that enemy or the person I've just killed or maimed or destroyed or the area I've contaminated, did they have the capability to suspend our Bill of Rights? Did they have the capability to overthrow our government? Did they have the ability to go in and attack us in our homes, in our towns, in our communities? The massive question that we all must ask, the massive question that we all must think about. I would suggest, and from all the work that I've done over the years and our whole team has seen, and there's an incredible number of people that really do care. I mean, they really do care. And we're trying to get the Department of Defense to care, and we're trying to get the Department of Veteran Affairs to care. I'd love to have one of the leaders from the Department of Defense, Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, call in on us a show. Maybe I'll try and get him as a guest. That'd be incredibly good. Get Dr. Harold Sosh from National Academy of Sciences to come on and discuss it. I'd love to get General Shinseki to come on and discuss it personally. Where does he fit in the ball? General Shinseki is the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. In 1993, General Shinseki, based on my input and our team's input, and as a result of the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute study inputs, he issued the first order mandating thorough medical care, environmental remediation, and training for everybody exposed to depleted uranium. He signed that order in August of 1993. As a consequence, I went on as the director of the Depleted Uranium Project, where we developed all the Army regulations dealing with DU. We developed all the technical specifications and the actual step-by-step procedures, and we developed the common task. All of us learned the soldier's common task, didn't we? To deal with DU and radiological materials. Again, we all put it together. And General Shinseki personally signed Army Regulation 700-48, U.S. Army Pamphlet 700-48, which specified that all this stuff has to be cleaned up, medical care must be provided, all this stuff has to be isolated. And he signed off on it as a Chief of Staff for the U.S. Army. We had a U.S. Army Technical Bulletin that was written back in the 80s, and first last version we had was September of 1990, right before Desert Storm started. Again, that was the criteria we used to clean up the DU mess and radiological material mess during Desert Storm. But based on our research and the Depleted Uranium Project, which we'll talk about extensively during this radio show, we wrote modified Technical Bulletin 913-278 that established the maximum dose rates, radiological dose rates for exposures, set up all the medical criteria, set up how do you decontaminate individuals that are exposed to radiological materials, and so forth. Again, General Shinseki signed off on all this stuff. He made it mandatory. He was the boss. Now we need his help. And again, I'm calling on General Shinseki to help us. Hey, boss, let's do what's right, please, sir. Let's take care of everybody without any more discussion, debate, or argument. The discussion, debate, and argument has gone on too long. The latest report placed that the Department of Veteran Affairs has over 800,000, over 800,000 backlog claims for medical care and disability. 800,000, ladies and gentlemen. That's our brothers and our sisters. That's our sons and our daughters, our uncles and our aunts, and in some cases, our grandparents. Because in all the stuff that we've been going on, we now have multiple generations that have been affected. We had multiple, one generation, myself and my best friends, we went to Vietnam and we went to Desert Storm. I have friends that went to Vietnam, Desert Storm, and went to our Operation Iraqi Freedom. All affected. And then our sons and daughters, those of us who were in Vietnam that went to Desert Storm, and our sons and daughters that went on to Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and New Dawn. Multiple generations that are seriously affected by the health and environmental effects of war. So as we go on, we'll have the discussions, we'll bring the experts on. Let's have an open discussion about the physiological and psychological adverse health effects of war. Let's have an ongoing discussion about the environmental effects of war and the requirements, the existing requirements within the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Coast Guard, to clean up that environmental contamination. And guess what? General Shinseki signed off on all the procedures himself. Shouldn't be a problem then, should it? Let's talk about the history of warfare. What happened? What did we see? What did we learn? What should we have learned? And what do we need to do in the future? Some of the things we look back and we look at Vietnam. And back in Vietnam, the thing that triggered the Vietnam War was a Gulf of Tonkin incident. Okay? Unfortunately, what we do know today from history is the Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur. Again, another one of those things that was built up and put together to get it all to happen. Unfortunately, it did not happen. So anyhow, again, we're looking back, all you Vietnam vets, all everybody out there, let's go back and think about what happened, what the consequences are, what happened after we left Vietnam. What are the consequences of Agent Orange on the Vietnamese and all the area people in that whole area? It's been a long-term devastating effect. We're looking at the Blue Water Navy again. All these individuals were in the U.S. Navy on the ships off the coast of Vietnam, or the guys who were running river rats running up and down. The other day I was in the post office here, and I ran into a river rat. The guy had been on one of those little Navy boats running up and down the rivers, again, exposed, horribly exposed to Agent Orange. He's got all of the neurological problems. He's got diabetes, and he's got the cardiac problems. All this stuff is directly related and showed up to the stuff with Agent Orange. So, again, we have to come on back. What happened in Vietnam? Why didn't they learn? Why are Vietnam vets, although it's getting better, still fighting for medical care some 40 years after we came back? I have to ask that question. My commanding general from Vietnam didn't tell me until 1996. He told me personally, told my wife and I personally, hey, Doug, I'm sorry to tell you, but we zapped you with Agent Orange. Thank you, sir. He wanted us to know. And you have to think about the health and environmental effects of Agent Orange and what has happened and how do we take care of that. Will all the Vietnam vets, all the Vietnamese, and all the other individuals, the troops from Australia and every place else in South Korea that came to Vietnam ever get the medical care that they earned because the United States decided to use a known toxic agent, Agent Orange, throughout the entire Southeast Asia and in Korea, by the way? And it affects and goes a long distance. It just doesn't sit there and go away. It's there for eternity. We know today that the physiological effects, the psychological effects on the population in Southeast Asia, where the area of Agent Orange was used, is still devastating. Birth defects are horrific, and they'll never end. We had the son of one of my compatriots. Again, we were exposed to Agent Orange, and again, his son died young. Again, direct byproduct, and here's what we can put together when we look at the medical literature. what his son died from match exactly what we expected and what we see on the Vietnamese children. Birth defects, horrific birth defects. So all this stuff came on down. It's been 40 years, over 40 years since I came back from Vietnam for the second time in Southeast Asia. And we're still seeing the same physiological and health effects of military operations without any seizure or stop. Well, I guess this is pretty much the end of our show, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have this show, Warrior Connection, on every Sunday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. Central Time. That is 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And I hope all of you will join us. If you got any information, get it to us. Please contact through the website to Warrior Connection, and we'll have a good day.